Good morning. I am teaching a public speaking class this semester, and I'm about to break all the rules I'm giving my students. This is not memorized. I have planned zero hand gestures. I am speaking from a script, not a keyword outline, and most of my students are in the room, so that's great. But hopefully they will be paying more attention to the content of the Book of Ruth than they are to my speaking skills, so it should be okay anyway. Okay, the Book of Ruth, I think I have slides here. Ah, yes, magic. The Book of Ruth follows the Book of Judges in the canon, probably because it takes place during the period of the Judges, although, as Dave mentioned last week, it could have originally been part of that book. Suggested authors include Samuel, that's according to rabbinic tradition, and Solomon, among others. But the truth is, we really don't know, and it doesn't make a great deal of difference to our understanding of the book. Ruth does serve as a valuable bridge from the time of the judges to the monarchy, and it's possible that one of the original purposes of the book was to justify the kingship of David, whose Moabite ancestry could have been seen as problematic. And if you remember, there wasn't exactly a smooth transition from the kingship of Saul to the kingship of David. So that's one possibility. But the themes in the book include covenant loyalty or steadfast kindness, divine providence, and the inclusion of the Gentiles in the people of God. Ruth is one of four women included in Matthew's genealogy of Jesus, three of whom, including Ruth, were Gentiles. While most of the historical books that we're covering actually cover long periods of history and they string together dozens of historical events, the Book of Ruth is a little different. It's just one relatively brief episode from the period of the Judges. Literarily, we would consider it a short story. Since one of the principles of hermeneutics is that we read the Bible just like we would read any other book, even while recognizing that it is the divinely inspired word of God, I thought I would approach Ruth the same way I would approach teaching any other short story. It might be good to follow along in a Bible if you have one this morning. You might find that helpful. A defining characteristic of any great story is that the author has packed a whole lot into a really short space. Generally, every detail is significant. There are no long, rambling chapters on Wales or the Paris sewer system, like you might find in Moby Dick or Les Mis, one of which I have vowed to never read. Not Les Mis, I'll read Les Mis. The author has had to pare down the details to just those most significant to his purpose. The structure of the story is carefully crafted, designed to highlight the author's intended purpose and themes, and Ruth is no exception. In addition to telling a really great story, the book is highly literary, as I think we'll see by working through the events of the plot. The author begins by giving us the setting. In the days when the judges ruled, during a famine in the land. After 400 years in Egypt and 40 years in the wilderness, God's people had entered the promised land, but it is not flowing with milk and honey this year. Why? Well, before they entered the land, God had given them explicit instructions. If the people were obedient, God promised to bless them. Among other blessings, they would enjoy protection from their enemies and abundant rain to produce plentiful crops. If they failed to obey, however, God pronounced a curse on them, including allowing enemies to oppress them and famine to occur in the land. As Dave showed us last week, the Book of Judges depicts this happening over and over again as the nation went through cycles of sin, oppression, and deliverance. Here in Ruth, we get an up-close and personal look at one family who lived through what was likely a famine resulting from disobedience. Maybe God didn't provide rain and the crops failed. Since there was apparently food, though, in the nearby land of Moab, perhaps it's more likely that he allowed the Midianite raiders, who were common during this period, remember Gideon threshing in a wine press to hide what he was doing from the Midianite raiders, Perhaps God allowed those Midianite raiders to steal or destroy the crops. Either way, in the town of Bethlehem, which ironically means house of bread, a man named Elimelech and his family lacked enough bread or anything else to eat. Now, the proper response to coming under a covenantal curse is, of course, repentance. We wouldn't want to engage in too much speculation, but it's interesting that repentance is not what we see here. Instead, we see Elimelech abandon his inheritance in the Promised Land for the land of Moab, the land of Israel's enemies, taking his wife Naomi and their two sons with him. We know that at this time, Israel had no king. Elimelech, whose name means God is king, abandons the land with no king except God, the land granted to his people by God himself, and seeks refuge in enemy territory. I would hate to move away from my home and family. Eric knows that if he decides to move across the country, it would be really tempting for me to say, I'll really miss you. I wouldn't really do that, but it would be tempting. Elimelech's desertion of the land, though, is not the same thing. It's far more drastic than a modern American family relocating. Their land was the land of promise, their inheritance from God himself. As Steve pointed out, it was the place where they were to be God's people, living in God's promised place, under God's rule and blessing. To leave that land was truly a desperate move, perhaps even a faithless one. To move to the land of the Moabites was especially ironic. The Moabites, descendants of Lot through an incestuous relationship with his daughter, had hired Balaam to curse the Israelites during their time in the desert. And after that was unsuccessful, they managed to incite the Lord's anger against his people by enticing them into sexual sin and idolatry in Numbers 25. Elimelech and Naomi didn't flee famine in the land of promise to seek a better life in a friendly country, but in the land of idolaters who worshipped Chemosh and who had lured Elimelech's people into the judgment of God. This was a drastic move. Well, whatever they hoped life in Moab would be like, those hopes were dashed. The sons took Moabite wives, Orpah and Ruth, but these unions came to nothing, producing no heirs. And the family's future looked even more bleak when not only Elimelech, but both of his sons died. Then Naomi hears word from home. Yahweh has provided food for his people. We'll see as we go on that this is only the first of many blessings or reversals that he provides in this story. The theme of God's provision runs through the whole book. Naomi decides to return to the land of promise, but she urges her daughters-in-law to stay, saying, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Here, Naomi expresses her hope that Yahweh, the Lord, will bless Orpah and Ruth with rest in the homes of new husbands. Rest here doesn't refer to rest from work, but rest in the sense of peaceful security. Naomi wants Yahweh to bless them with new homes and husbands who will provide security for them. But she's encouraging them to seek this rest in the land of Moab, among idol worshipers. Initially, they both protest. They declare their intention to follow her. But Orpah eventually tearfully complies and turns back. Naomi urges Ruth to do the same and even says, "Your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." What a strange piece of advice from a follower of the one true God. Maybe it came from absorbing the thinking of the polytheistic cultures around her, as we saw in story after story in Judges. It seems that at this point in the story that Naomi might be being faithless. She acknowledges Yahweh, but pleads with Orpah and Ruth to seek rest apart from him. If this is a faithless act on her part, this makes her redemption later in the story even more dramatic. Now, great authors frequently present us with pairs or parallels. When they do this, they are inviting us to compare the two situations. In Hamlet, there's this guy named Fortinbras who keeps being brought up. It's left out of most productions. And you might be thinking, like, why do they keep talking about this Fortinbras guy who's wandering around? Well, the deal is, both Hamlet and Fortinbras were sons seeking to avenge the deaths of their fathers. But they handle their situations in very different ways. Hamlet ends up a corpse on the stage. Fortinbras ends up walking in on the stage of corpses and saying, I guess I'm king of Denmark now. Like, these two parallel situations end very differently because of their different choices. And if Shakespeare's not your thing, it's okay. All sorts of storytellers do this. In sitcoms, a lot of times you'll see two sets of characters going through two different situations, and it bounces back and forth between the two storylines. But there'll be something the same about those storylines, something that ties them together. Well, we see that here. Orpah turns back, but Ruth clings to Naomi, her people and her God. She says, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." I don't know Hebrew, but apparently the Hebrew makes this more clear, more emphatic, reading literally, "Your people, my people. Your God, my God." Since Ruth will presumably outlive the older Naomi, her commitment isn't merely to caring for her mother-in-law, although that's included. She's vowing to remain in the land of the Israelites even after Naomi's death and to be buried in the land that God has given them. How much she understood at this point about Yahweh, we aren't told, but she was determined to cling to Naomi's God while Orpah followed Naomi's advice and returned. Now, Ruth likely realized that she was, quite possibly, giving up the chance to find security in the home of a new husband. Naomi had no more sons to whom she could be given in marriage. She would be living as a foreigner in a culture in which most people married within their family clans. Her best prospect for marriage would probably have been to return to her mother's home, just like Orpah did. But Ruth refuses. Well, when the two women arrive in Bethlehem, Naomi bemoans her situation, saying, "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." She changes her name from Naomi, which means pleasant, to a name that means bitter. Naomi here appears to be wallowing in a bit of self-pity. Her focus seems to be on her own circumstances rather than on the character of God, his provision of food for his people in the land, or his gift of Ruth to her. Nevertheless, we wouldn't want to be too harsh on her. Her situation actually is dire. She has been left with no certain way to provide for herself, no prospect of children to provide her security or to carry on the family line. Ruth, though, is truly a blessing to Naomi. Ruth asks to go out in the fields and pick up leftover grain. Now, God had actually instructed the Israelites to leave grain in the corners of the field and not to be too thorough in gathering all the grain in a field in order to provide the poor food that the poor could go out and glean. Ruth just happens to end up gleaning in the field of Boaz, who meets her there after hearing a good report about her. He encourages her to continue gleaning in his fields where she'll be safe, and to drink his harvester's water when she's thirsty. He tells her he's heard all about her kindness to Naomi since her husband's death, and says, "May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. This metaphor of seeking refuge under God's wings probably doesn't have the intended impact for most of us in modern America. We don't tend to spend too much time in nature observing birds. That's probably a detriment. But this is an image used of God multiple times in Scripture, especially in the Psalms. Psalm 91 says, "Surely he will save you from the fowler's snare and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will seek refuge." The picture is of a protective mother bird providing safety and refuge from danger under her wings. When God's people walked in obedience to him, they lived in a refuge provided by the Almighty Creator of the universe. Boaz recognizes that in abandoning the land of Moab to care for Naomi, Ruth has sought refuge with God's people under his wings. So, Ruth continues working in Boaz's field and tells Naomi all about it when she returns home. Naomi, for the first time recorded in the book, responds not with bitterness, but by recognizing God's faithfulness. "The Lord bless him," Boaz. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. That man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers." Whose kindness Naomi has in mind isn't exactly clear, Boaz's or God's, or perhaps God's kindness shown to them through Boaz. The word for kindness, hesed, speaks of steadfast covenant faithfulness, even when the recipient is undeserving. It's the disposition to show often unearned, abundant grace and goodness. One of the ways God showed this kindness was through the institution of the kinsman redeemer, or goel. The goel was a relative who could perform some act of redemption or justice on behalf of a family member in need. The root of the word means to redeem or buy back. They were tasked with caring for family members who found themselves in tough circumstances. They were to bring about justice if a relative was murdered. They were to liberate a family member who had become desperate enough to sell himself into slavery. They could provide an heir for a brother who had died childless, or buy back a field or land which had been a forfeited inheritance. Those last two are of particular importance to Naomi. Naomi begins to hope that Boaz will enter into a variation of levirate marriage with Ruth. If a man died, leaving no heir, his brother, or in this case, near relative, was to marry his widow. Their first son was legally considered the son of the deceased brother, ensuring that his name would be carried on. This son would inherit his legal father's allotted portion of the promised land. This also provided for the needs of the widow, who otherwise might be left in dire circumstances, and Naomi and Ruth were in just such circumstances. Though she doesn't say so in her instructions to Ruth, we'll see later in the story that the other function of the kinsman redeemer Naomi hopes that Boaz will fulfill relates to the family land. Remember that back in the book of Joshua, when the Israelites took possession of the promised land, God gave instructions to divide the land among the tribes and clans, and that land was to remain the property of that clan forever, passed down from generation to generation. So their concept of land ownership was very different from ours. The land, in a very real sense, represented the promises of God. It was their share in the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. In an agricultural society, it was also the means of providing for yourself and your family. So when someone became poor and sold his land, sold his share of God's promise, the law provided a way for it to be recovered. Every 50th year was a year of Jubilee, in which all land was returned to the original clan. Before the Jubilee year, a man who had sold his land had the right to redeem it, to buy it back from the purchaser, if he could come up with the money. If he was unable to buy it back himself, a relative could redeem it for him. Leviticus 25 reads, "The land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine, and you are but aliens and my tenants. Throughout the country that you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. If one of your fellow Israelites becomes poor and sells some of his property, his nearest relative is to come and redeem what he has sold." Someone who, in his poverty, had lost the promises of God could have them restored to him through the mercy of a relative. Naomi hopes that Boaz will be willing to fulfill this role by marrying Ruth and providing descendants as well as a home where Ruth will be well provided for. And Naomi devises a scheme that sounds downright bizarre to us. Ruth will wash and perfume herself, put on her best clothes, hang around the threshing floor, wait until Boaz lies down to go to sleep, and then lie down at his feet and wait for him to tell her what to do. To us, this is just plain weird. Some have suggested that uncover his feet is being used as a euphemism, and that the scene involved immoral activity. This seems hardly likely, though, when we note that there's a complete absence of any disapproval on the part of the narrator, and especially when we come to Boaz's comment just a few verses later, that all of their fellow townsmen know that Ruth is a woman of noble character. If her actions here were immoral, we would expect some kind of qualification of this observation of her character. Ruth does just what Naomi tells her. Things go according to plan, and Boaz is startled in the middle of the night to find a woman lying at his feet. Ruth's appeal to him is significant. "I am your servant, Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." We lose the literary beauty here in our English translations. The Hebrew for corner of your garment is the same as that for wings. So earlier, Boaz had proclaimed a blessing on Ruth from the Lord, under whose wings she had sought refuge. And here, she entreats him to be the agent of that blessing by covering her with his wing. Years later, Ezekiel would use the same language to describe God's metaphorical marriage to Israel. In chapter 16, he says, "When I, God, looked at you, Israel, and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment," literally, "I spread my wings over you and covered your nakedness." Ruth is asking for Boaz's protection and provision in marriage since he is a kinsman redeemer. Boaz's reply reveals his admiration for Ruth's character. "The Lord bless you, my daughter. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor." We might initially read this as appreciation for Ruth's kindness to Boaz, but when we look closer, that doesn't really seem to be the most likely reading. If Boaz is referring to Ruth's kindness to himself, what was the kindness she showed earlier? She really hasn't benefited him at all up to this point. And what's the kindness being shown now? I mean, being willing to marry a wealthy man who probably wouldn't have had trouble finding a son who's, or finding a wife whose first son wouldn't legally be considered somebody else's, like that seems like a weird kind of kindness. It seems more likely that he means Ruth's kindness to Naomi and her family. Ruth could have sought a marriage to a younger man outside her husband's family, either in Moab or Judah. So to seek a marriage instead within her dead husband's family is to show kindness by providing an heir for Elimelech and Mahlon, whose names will now be preserved with the land given to them by God, and to show kindness to Naomi, who will now have descendants to care and provide for her in her old age. Boaz praised Ruth's kindness to Naomi when he met her first at the gleaning, and he sees now that she's showing even more kindness to her husband's family. Boaz knows there's a catch in the plan, though. He is a close relative, but there is one closer who has a stronger claim to Mahlon's land and his widow. At the end of chapter 3, we're left rooting for a marriage between Boaz and Ruth, but knowing there's a very real obstacle, an unnamed kinsman. Boaz goes to the town gate, the usual place for business and legal transactions at the time, and he invites this unnamed man to have a seat. He invites the elders of the town to sit down too, as witnesses to whatever is about to transpire. He says, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling a piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line." The details of this rite of redemption aren't exactly clear. Boaz says that Naomi is selling the land, while the property law regarding a kinsman redeemer applies to a piece of land that has already been sold. There are some possibilities. Maybe Naomi still owns the land, but she's so impoverished that she must sell, and a near relative could be called upon to buy it back in order to keep it in the family. Maybe Elimelech sold the land before moving to Moab, and what Naomi is selling, so to speak, is the right to redeem it, to repurchase it, and restore it to the family. But whatever the case, it's some variant of the kinsman redeemer law, and this man is in a position to fulfill it. And he says he will. This could turn out all right for Ruth and Naomi. The land would be redeemed, and the family line could continue, but it's not the ending that either of them, or Boaz, or we as the readers, have been led to hope for. We're rooting for Boaz and Ruth. Then Boaz adds one little detail he's neglected to mention. "On the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property." Does Boaz include the detail about Ruth's ancestry to make the deal less appealing? Hard to say, but maybe. Either way, it's no longer a deal the man thinks is in his best interests. And he says, "Then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it." How exactly would marriage to Ruth endanger his own estate? He doesn't explain, but one possibility is he would, of course, have to use money to buy the land. Money which would no longer be part of his own children's inheritance. And that land would not pass to a child who was legally considered his own, but to the first son born to him and Ruth, a child who would legally be considered Mahlon's. Whatever this case, the man considered the redemption of an impoverished family member too costly. This is another pair of characters, set in contrast to each other. Earlier, we saw Orpah's return to Moab bring Ruth's faithful kindness into sharper focus. Here, the unwillingness of the unnamed kinsman to risk his own property on behalf of another highlights Boaz's kindness to Ruth and Naomi. There was shame in an unwillingness to fulfill the redemptive role of kinsman redeemer. Remember Onan, the son of Judah, who was put to death for failing to perform his levirate duty and provide a son for his dead brother? Since this near relative in Ruth wasn't an actual sibling of Mahlon, he wasn't legally or morally required to do so, but it still probably wouldn't have been highly regarded to refuse to help needy family members this way. Ironically, though, the man's very motive seems to have been to ensure a name for himself, but he's the character left unnamed in the biblical story we are still reading thousands of years later. The elders at the gate who witnessed this agreement then chime in with a blessing on Boaz. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. If you remember the story of Judah and Tamar, it might at first seem a weird one to allude to in a marriage blessing. Judah, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, had three sons, Onan, and Shelah. Was married to a woman named Tamar, but he was put to death by God for his wickedness. So Judah told his next son, Onan, to produce offspring for his brother by marrying Tamar. Onan, we're told, didn't want to father a child who would not be considered his own offspring, but his brother's, so he avoided impregnating Tamar. God considered this so wicked, he put Onan to death. Judah sent Tamar back to her father's house with a false promise of giving the third son, Shelah, to her, but he had no such intention. When time passed and Tamar realized that she was still languishing as a widow, she dressed up as a prostitute and tricked Judah himself into sleeping with her and fathering twins, Perez and Zerah. This is who the elders of Bethlehem are referring to. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Now the descendants of Perez were numerous, so the tribe of Judah had become prominent in Israel through that union, but still, what a sordid tale to compare Boaz and Ruth's union to. Unless we look at the parallels and compare them. Ruth and Tamar were each childless widows of Israelite husbands, and they were each hoping to find security with a kinsman redeemer. Tamar resorts to trickery to obtain an offspring that Judah should have provided through her through his youngest son. Ruth is willingly provided for by Boaz. In contrast to both the unnamed kinsman and to Judah, Boaz acts as a faithful kinsman redeemer. This inclusion of an allusion to Tamar and Judah makes more sense when we recognize these parallels. In literature, allusions matter. So, Boaz marries Ruth, and the Lord provides them with a son, Obed. The women to whom Naomi had previously proclaimed herself bitter and empty now exclaim, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." This is the kind of God they have, one who renews life even when all has seemed hopeless. The story includes a number of reversals. It begins with Elimelech and Naomi leaving the land and ends with their ancestral land restored. If we remember what Steve told us a couple weeks ago about the importance of God's people inhabiting God's place for them under God's rule, we see the significance of this restoration. The story begins with famine and hunger, which turn to images of harvesting, gleaning, and measures of barley filling a shawl. We see another reversal when the barrenness of both Ruth and Naomi is turned to fruitfulness with the birth of Obed. Ruth becomes a widow at the beginning of the book, as does Naomi, but this is reversed when Ruth becomes a bride at the end. In the context of the history of the nation of Israel, perhaps the biggest reversal is one we have to step back a bit to see. The book ends with a genealogy that traces the line from Perez, the son of Judah and Tamar, to Boaz and Ruth, to King David. Even in the midst of Israel's tumultuous times of disobedience, God was at work. While his people had no king, and everyone did as he saw fit, God was sovereignly working to provide a king. The book of Judges ends with the bleak statement that Israel had no king, and the book of Ruth ends with the name of Israel's greatest king. What was lacking in the time of Judges, God provided. The original readers of Judges and Ruth would have seen God's covenant loyalty, his sovereignty, and his provision in this beautiful account. This book would have been a touching reminder to the ancient Israelites that God provided for two widows in dire straits, that he provided for the nation as a whole when they were in need, in spite of their unfaithfulness. And with the additional revelation we have in Jesus, we can see that God's covenant loyalty, his sovereignty, and his provision continued. It's part of redemptive history. Through the institution of the kinsman redeemer, God raised up David, and eventually, through David's line, a greater David, a greater kinsman redeemer. The original readers would have known the chaos of Judges, the story of Tamar and Judah, and the greatness of King David. We also have Micah 5:2. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. The ancient Israelites read of Boaz, a descendant of Judah, who redeemed a bride for himself from the nation of Moab. And we know that God continued this pattern when a later descendant of Judah redeemed a bride for himself from all nations. Through our sin, we have forfeited the promises of God. Unlike the Old Testament Israelite who might acquire enough money to buy back what he'd lost, we can never redeem what we've lost on our own. We regain what was lost only through the mercy of Jesus, the ultimate kinsman redeemer. A kinsman redeemer had to be a kinsman. This is not an insignificant detail, especially when we look at the perfect kinsman redeemer, Christ. Only by becoming our kinsman, becoming fully human, could Jesus be our redeemer. If he weren't fully human, his death would not have been an acceptable substitute for ours. So he became just that. The eternal second person of the Trinity took on flesh, shared in our humanity, so that by his death, he might free those who all our lives were held in slavery by our fear of death. Knowing all along his plan to redeem us, God gave us picture after picture, hint after hint of how that plan would play out. And the role of the kinsman redeemer is one of those pictures. Ruth is a beautiful tale of God's provision for two widows living in desperate circumstances. It's a reminder that even in a turbulent age of unfaithfulness on the part of his people, God was faithful, providentially working to provide a king for his people. And as a small but important piece of redemptive history, this brief story is really a microcosm of the gospel. Boaz's redeeming love for Ruth is a little picture for us of Christ's redeeming love for his bride. Like Ruth and Naomi, we can't provide what we really need, but thanks be to God, we have a kinsman redeemer who has. Amen. Who's closing?